Today, I hope to consider this as a very informal talk, just discussing this recent works I'm doing about this tensor networks and its relation to space-time geometry. So this so the first half of the talk will be about this paper in 2013, and that's about this approach I call the exact holographic mapping. And I will explain that it's something I propose as a kind of naive way to understand holography and alternative way to understand holography, hopefully. And then we will talk about what's the consequence of that, try to relating the entanglement structure in the quantum state to space-time geometry. And that's the second, and the second part will be about applying it to several systems. I guess the talk is 1 hour, right? So this the unpublished part of the work is in collaboration with Michael Zalatell in CNQ and my students Yingfei Gu and Qinghua Li, and also Xinsui Liu and his group members in UIUC, Gil Chou and Xue Dawen. So just some general background. So why do I want to do this? It's all motivated by this ADS-CFT correspondence proposed in 97. And I won't reveal too much about what is this ADS-CFT, except mentioning two important aspects of it, which is relevant to what I'm going to talk about. One is its relation to renormalization group. So you can think this, so this duality is a duality between d-dimensional series and d+1 dimensional series. And then in the d-dimensional theory, it's considered as a many-body system or quantum field theory, which means there's no fluctuation of background, no gravity. And the other one is considered as gravity theory. And its relation has been discussed it has been discussed that it's related to renormalization group in the sense that you can think about the additional direction as energy scale, and you can think about equation of motion in that direction as a generalization of renormalization group flow. So, and this has been a very good observation because it tells us that it's something that's more general than the several theories that where this was proposed originally. It can be applied to different systems and hopefully become useful for condensed matter. And then there is the other aspect of this duality, which is the relation to quantum entanglement. So this started from this very important work of Xinsui Liu and Tadashi Takayanagi, where they propose that you can generalize this Hawking formula, Bekenstein-Hawking formula, relating black hole area and black hole entropy. You can generalize that formula to a general surface that's a minimal surface bounding a region near the boundary, and the area of that minimal surface is proposed to be a holographic dual of the entropy of that area. And this has been verified in many cases, and it has been proved for particular regimes. So
Talking about the entanglement, it's exactly zero temperature.
not necessarily. You can do this calculation in a geometry with black hole, and then it's like entanglement entropy in a finite temperature state. Well, it's not, it's an entropy of that region, which may contain the entanglement with the rest of the system, and it may contain the entanglement with the thermal bath. That is the entropy of that region.
It's a total entropy.
Of this region, yeah. The reduced density matrix of that region. So this then motivated the later work that tried to relate this to the tensor networks. And there is a particular kind of tensor network which was not proposed for this purpose, and that was the MIRA proposed by Guifry et al. Here. And MIRA is a way to try to capture the entanglement property of a critical state by a tensor network, which means if you describe a system in an ordinary way, like a matrix product state, then it doesn't capture this entropy that grows with the system, with the size of the subsystem. Right? So then Guifry proposed this different kind of tensor network, which now has the ability of capturing the fact that the entropy of a region keep growing in a log L way. Since Brian Swingle's work in 2010, it has been proposed to relate to ADS-CFT. Intuitively, because this tensor network has a structure of a hyperbolic space. But a lot of open questions still remains about what's the relation of this thing to ADS-CFT, because this corresponds to a state. So you don't explicitly have a time direction, and there is a causal structure along this direction which makes the direction looks like a time. And you may have heard this talk of Bartek Cech earlier this week relating to this problem. So all these are motivations, and then I would like to explain what I want to what I really want to do with it. And that's one thing that's not clear here, because a tensor network usually describes a state, and that means it's like a zero temperature. It's like a state. Although you can describe a mixed state ensemble by describing the whole pure state of a doubled system, and then you trace over part of.
That's a tensor tensor product operator, something like that. You can
But so far, all these discussions are about tensor.
So your topic just restricted to zero temperature.
No. These are just motivation. Okay. But that's part of the thing I want to do a little better than the tensors that represent states. So now I'm going to start introducing this approach. I first should say a disclaimer that some of you may be here last year when I gave this talk. So the first half, I think I should keep it self-contained. So the first half will be an introduction of the setup. And then in the second half, I will talk about some more recent works. So basically, what I want to do is starting from some very general thoughts about geometry. So naively, so when we usually think about geometry, after Einstein, we all think about metric and curvature and all these things which are determined by metric. And if now I don't have a continuous manifold to start with, I have some lattice system with spins or something with discrete coordinates, right? So then what replaces metric is basically distance between points. You may not be able to summarize this in a nice metric tensor, but at least you should have points and distance between them. Right? Then it's good enough. Well, if the distance is a distance that's consistent with all these conditions that, about the distance function. So if you give me a quantum state, which means I have a wave function of many spins or something like that, how do you define the points? That's very different from the classical case where, to start with, you are already given a particular basis. If you think in a quantum way, then classical system is like you're already given a particular a real space coordinate. But the quantum system may give you a state in a Hilbert space, and you can do any unitary transformation to it. So I would say a definition of point is like a way to factorize the Hilbert space into direct product of different points. So say you have a real space spaces where electrons can sit on 1, 2, 3, 4. And then you can also Fourier transform it to momentum space where you can talk about the electron occupying momentum 1, 2, 3, 4. And these are I will view as different definitions of points. But some of them are better definition than others because of the second thing. Because once you define these points, then I can talk about distance between the points. And I don't have a complete answer about what should be the best definition of distance. But one thing is clear, that following Einstein's relativity principle, this distance shouldn't be just something you add by hand. It should be dependent on the physical state. And to be more precise, if you have physical correlation functions between the two sites, which means you have operator act on this factor Hilbert space and you have operator acting on another one, you can calculate correlation functions between them. And the correlation functions should have something to do with distance. If two sites are absolutely no correlated at all, then it should be considered as distance infinity, because if you sit on this site, there's nothing you can detect about the other site. If two sites are very correlated, then you should think they are close to each other. So I want to translate that into a formula. So then what do we do is we should study the system we understand best, which is we start from a massive system, ground state of the massive system. Then the ground state of a massive system, we know it has correlation functions that decay exponentially in real space. So here, this is this formula. The correlation function is the exponential function of distance. This formula is what we usually think. We usually think we already have a definition of distance, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we use that, we write a relation between that and the correlation function. So now I want to reverse this logic and say, if I don't have other ways to measure distance, I want to use this to measure the distance. So I just reverse this formula and write the distance as defined to be minus cosine times log of the correlation function. So if you allow me to do that, then it may not be we don't know if it's a generally good definition, but at least for this state, it gives me a definition that reproduces reproduce the geometry we're familiar with.
So in this definition, somehow from somewhere, you have information about the correlation length, as opposed to, I mean, the usual way you would do it is that you would, compute that, measure that correlator at different distances and extract a correlation length out.
Yeah, so I don't think you can decide the absolute value of the correlation length if you don't have any other way to measure it. So in the physical system, what happened is in our universe, we have many other, we have many different particles with different mass. And what you can determine is dimensionless ratios between correlation lengths of different particles, which is, I should think of this picture as like, you think of the mass gap here as the Planck scale. And most particles has that kind of mass. And then there's a few modes which has lower mass. So when you calculate the distance, it's mainly dominated by that thing. And then this correlation length is like a Planck scale of your theory. It's something like that.
What do you mean by most particles have mass scale of Planck?
Because otherwise it won't make sense to think have low energy particles moving on some background. Like if you calculate the entropy of a region, there should be a cutoff scale. The scale that appears in the Hawking entropy formula is basically by comparing the area with the Planck area, because the entropy is like dimensionless. So in that sense, I would like to think that there is actually a lot of local degrees of freedoms in the Planck scale, which contribute most to the distance.
So
that's not generally the case. I'm going to talk about a theory with only one fermion, and then we don't have this separation between high energy and low energy. Sorry.
So Pierre, when you think about this system, it's a lattice system or the continuum?
It's a lattice system.
Yeah, so then this lattice scale is supposed to be...
That's right, but the lattice scale is not directly measurable by this way. I mean, what you see is the correlation length. So if I really only have this...
The lattice scale is something even higher, completely invisible.
It's something, at least in the way of calculating correlation functions, is not directly observable.
I mean, you're basically erasing all that information from this, right? So you're just saying, I got this from a lattice system. Now let me pretend it never existed. Let me just define things this way.
Yep.
And then what you say is that really all the information I have are going to be ratios. all the physical information I'm going to ever have
yes.
are ratios.
Yes. Like later when I talk about AES readers, that's also in the unit of these ratios. So, okay. So one thing I want to mention is there is a slightly better measure if you want to talk about spatial geometry. Because when you talk about spatial geometry, which means equal time correlation functions, then we have an upper bound of all the equal time correlation, connected equal time correlation function, which is the mutual information. You calculate the entropy of this site, entropy of that site, subtract the entropy of the two together, that tells you how much correlation is between the two sites. Right? The extreme example is a EPR pair. When you have two things that are entangled, the entropy of this is maximal, entropy of that is maximal, the two together, entropy is zero. That's the maximal entropy case. That's the maximal mutual information case. So I will define that to be my distance zero, because you can't have more correlation than that. So anything that has correlation smaller than that is considered as two points that has some distance. So in general, I still like to write it in this way of correlation function because I don't have a generalization of this mutual information to finite, to different time. So this distance definition works okay, which means if you have some creature living in that universe and you give them this formula, they will figure out the geometry in the same way, and the geometry will be the same as what you see in the long distance. But then now if you tune the parameter and drive the system to a critical point, something will go wrong. Because so that the ordinary view, which is that if you sit outside of this universe and you know the geometry is flat, then you will say, okay, the geometry doesn't change at all, correlation function changes, correlation function becomes power law. So now if you So now the 2 points got more correlated than this case. So then, but if you live in that system, you don't have other correlation functions to access. You don't have another ruler. Then what you have to do is you insist to use the same formula of distance, and then you conclude that your distance becomes the log of the Euclidean distance, because it's a log of the correlation function. Right? So then actually, if you are a physicist in that universe, you later realize that it's not just a change of the distance behavior. It's telling you that your distance is not a classical distance anymore, because a classical Riemann distance should satisfy this triangle inequality, which means any 2 points, the distance is smaller than this plus that, right, or equal to. But the key point is this equal sign must be able to be taken. So you must be able to find another point which is along the geodesic of x to y, so that dxz plus dyz equals to dxy. That's always the case for Riemann geometry, even if you have a curved space.
Riemann geometry has a time graph, so the metric.
Yeah, yeah.
This triangle inequality is not
satisfied. So I'm talking about the spatial geometry, right? Well, that's right. So in general, because I don't know how to define this distance for real time direction. But imaginary time is basically similar to space. But if I do a real time evolution, then the correlation functions oscillate rather than decay. So I shouldn't think of directly taking a log of correlation, because what you get is oscillations with different frequencies, and you're not taking the leading one if you're just taking the log of them. So basically, because this map is from you start from a quantum state and it's time evolution, and at any state you map this to some geometry in the sense of distance. So it's like you already chosen a spatial slice in your geometry. Yeah.
So when you measure the distance by the correlation function, how you consider the effect like back reaction?
Although we are not guaranteed to get like Einstein gravity or anything like that, but it does automatically have back reaction. I mean, this distance formula tells you physical correlation functions determine distance. So that means if you change the state of your matter, you automatically change the geometry. And I will discuss mainly the example of black hole, which means if you change the state of your system from zero temperature to finite temperature, of course, correlation function changes, and that will translate to a geometry change. So that is like a back reaction. Okay, so what I'm going to say, what I'm trying to say in this slide is that if you define the distance formula for massive system and apply it to the massless system, you find this distance is not given by a metric. And then going back to my earlier point of defining the points, so I want to view this ambiguity or the freedom you have to define different set of points as something like a general covariance, which means you can define completely different definitions of points, and then the behavior of distance will look different. So now if you find that this basis, when you define this real space point and calculate distance, when you find this distance definition is not very good, is not very classical, then you may try to find another basis. And that's the point that I think is related to this holographic duality. So basically, what I want to say in the following is the holographic duality is like a basis change. So you describe the same system by a new basis, where say a local operator in the new space will be something not local in the original space. But but if you have all the operators in the new system, it's the same as you have all the operators in the old system. So it's related by unitary mapping. But the point is that because you have changed the definition, what do you mean by point, what do you mean by a local operator defined on a point, then the geometry in the new basis looks different, and it's natural to guess that it looks like ADS space, because this picture that if you have 2 points with distance and you want to define the distance to be log x minus y, then it's natural to think it as on the boundary of a hyperbolic space, so that the geodesic distance is indeed a log of x minus y. So it's just saying that if you can find such a mapping, map this system to living in a hyperbolic space, then this it's actually the same correlation function behavior, the same formula for distance, but now this one looks like a geodesic distance. In the original basis, it doesn't look like a geodesic distance because dxz plus dyz is always bigger than dxy. And in this way, it's okay because you know what's the reason of that. The reason of dxz plus dyz always bigger than dxy is this geodesic doesn't go through z. It goes through some other point.
In this map, where is this correlation length called C arises from? Because on the left side in the CFT, there's no particular.
So basically, this thing on the exponential will be dimensionless, right? So there will be some other length scale divided by C which show up. And there's
so
some other length scale with ADS.
In this map, you need some regulation on the boundary?
No. The boundary has a dimensionless number, which is delta. And the bulk has a dimensionless number, which is the ADS readers divided by Kc. That's the mapping. So the delta is mapped to R over Kc.
But in this map, how do you compute the Kc?
Well, I'm proposing this mapping and then use the known behavior of correlation function to determine that distance. Right? So you compute the R over Kc from delta. And then in the special case, in the special case of free fermion I'm going to talk about, I can also compute R and Kc separately as a function of the lattice scale by just more detailed comparison with the ADS geometry. So let me explain what do I mean by this change of basis. So you want to find another basis. Basically, okay, the general thing you want to do is you want to find a unitary mapping in the whole Hilbert space. And the output of the unitary mapping is a new set of points, which is a new set of a new way to factorize your Hilbert space. So you map this this local operator on each site to a new set of operators, and these operators, what you hope to achieve is these operators that are more short range correlated than the old one. So I would like to define the mapping in a local way, and so let's define it like this. So you start from two sites, and then you define the unitary mapping between the two sites to two other sites. So this is a two-site unitary. So if you have a qubit on each site, it's a 4x4 unitary matrix, which acts on these two sites, give you two output sites. And physically, what you want to do is you want this mapping to give a site here which contains the high energy degrees of freedom, and a site here which contains low energy degrees of freedom. What does that mean? It means that because, as I mentioned, this unitary mapping changes a way to factorize your Hilbert space. So your Hilbert space is H1 times H2, the two-side Hilbert space. But now it becomes H1 prime times H2 prime. And then in this new factorization, so now you know what you mean by an operator living here, and what an operator living here. And what I mean is I want all the operators living here to be high end, to be high energy, which means if you look at its Heisenberg evolution, it's high frequency, and the operators here are low energy. That's basically what this separation wants to do.
Compared to
each other. So you try to separate as much as possible the high frequency and low frequency modes of the system.
But I mean, isn't there some scale that you should be comparing? I mean, usually if I think about it, there's a cutoff scale and things are high or low compared to that cutoff.
Well, it's because for simplicity, I'm defining the mapping so that the degree of freedom is separated equally, which means, say, if this is a qubit, this is a qubit. There's two states. This is also two states. Mm-hmm. So where can you cut the energy will depend on your density of state. But you always separate the degrees of freedom to two and two. So then you can just continue this mapping. So this is really like RG. You take the low energy ones and then separate it into the part that's higher in energy and the part that's lower, and then you keep going. So basically, in the end, what you get is a separation in energy scales. Say, originally you have a fermion with this energy scale, and then you are basically cutting in half every time. So you put all these high energy things in the first layer, and all these things in the second layer, all these things in the third layer. So. But this is not. This is just roughly. This is just on average. You're doing this. You're not really doing this kind of sharp cut in momentum space. Otherwise, that's not local, and that's not going to give you any interesting entanglement between different layers. So the core point is, you not only want a unitary mapping, you want a mapping that's sort of local. that's also like the idea of Mira. I'm going to mention the relation to Mira in the next slide, next two slides. So basically, this is like a lossless version of a real space RG. So why do I say it's a lossless? It's not. I'm not integrating over anything. I'm not integrating over the states in high energy or dropping them. I'm just separating them in a different way. I'm grouping my degrees of freedom in a different way. And then the advantage is I can talk about things that people never talk about in RG, which is like, what is the entanglement between your high energy degrees of freedom and low energy degrees of freedom? And that's important here because I want to talk about the geometry between, I want to talk about distance between these points.
Okay, talk about the RG called wave function, not for the
Lagrangian. This is a unitary mapping, so I can apply it to, it's not Lagrangian, but it's applying to the Hamiltonian. I can apply the unitary mapping to Hamiltonian. So I can apply the same mapping to not only the ground state but excited states. So it's not a so that's one key point that the mapping
for wave function and the Hamiltonian, this RG has been known just a kind of a sequence of local unitary transformations, but for this Lagrangian, it's exponential minus h, it's slightly different. That's a field theory formulation. It's not exactly unitary.
I'm not sure. I mean, even for wave function, usually you don't think RG is exact. So I don't.
Exactly, we wrote many papers on that. For
this classification, just the classification is only defined for, it's only worked out for gap states, right? The topological classification. Yeah,
but so, in a general sense, you can also apply this local unity to computer, like a center charge scheme dimension, numerical sense.
That's for the space-time tensor network, yeah.
I think for wave function, it's not very unusual if you apply local unit. But I mean, the field theory RG is slightly different.
If you mean how to take the continuum limit, I haven't figured out yet. So the thing is that for any lattice system to start with, when I do this, I have to break translation symmetry. So it's a unitary mapping, so I didn't physically break translation symmetry, but the basis doesn't explicitly have translation symmetry in it. I don't know whether that's related to what you said, but basically one point is, I do want to make the point that I'm defining a unitary mapping, so I'm just changing the basis, this discriminative physics. So I not only have one state, I also want to talk about, say I have some dynamics that create some particle and it's propagating, and then it corresponds to something happening in the bulk. So I don't want to stick with only one state. And that's also one difference from Mira, although the construction is very similar, it's just used in a different way. In Mira, it's considered as a tensor network representation of a state. So the proposal is, in my language here, I would like to say you also first define the unitary mapping, but then you apply the reverse mapping to a simple state in the bulk, which is Dirac product state, and then you get a boundary state. You reverse the mapping, and then so if you restrict yourself to the states that are obtained by a reverse mapping from the Dirac product state, then this is a set of states described by Mira, and it has nice properties that can be studied. So then the difference here is I don't want to make this ansatz. I want to keep the entanglement between the sites because I need that to measure the entanglement, to measure the geometry. So that the geometry is not just given by the way you draw the tensor network, and you can see that even if you draw the tensor network in exactly the same way, you define the same unitary, the geometry can look different.
Can we go back? So your network doesn't have this
entangler. That's right. Yeah.
So if you want to comment on that.
Yeah. So basically, I can have disentanglers. I can take exactly the same tensor network as Mira and then say now I want to treat this as unitary mapping rather than a state. Actually, I will talk about that as an improvement later. And then the point is I don't have to have these disentanglers because I didn't throw away the entanglement between the box states. So when I didn't throw away the entanglement between the bulk size, then even if I don't have these entanglers, I didn't lose anything. But if you throw away the entanglement between box size, which means if you make this assumption, we make this ansatz, then it's very essential to have these entanglers. Otherwise, this thing has a very bad entanglement property that this four size has very little entanglement with the other four because there is only one bound connecting them. So basically, it's I don't have the disentanglers here because the entanglement is captured by the entanglement between the boxes. And then once you define this mapping, then we can follow the logic earlier. We can define correlation functions between the box points, which is like some unitary transformation of some boundary correlation functions. So you calculate correlation functions and you can define the distance, and then now you can try to verify whether this really is the right mapping to take, because whether the correlation is really more short range than the boundary. It's really the correlation decays exponentially with some classical distance. So I think I'm going a little bit slow. So the explicit example, of this is I take a simple free fermion. So this is a lattice version of Dirac model. If you take k goes to zero limit, this is like a linear k term and a mass term. And these cosine terms are there for regularizing the theory so that you don't have doubling partners. So it's a Dirac fermion, and if you take mass to zero, it's a CFT in the long wavelength limit. And then in this case, we can define the unitary just by inspection, just because physically we know what kind of unitaries you can separate high energy and low energy states, because in this free case, the low energy states means k close to zero. High energy states has k close to pi. So you are taking the two sides, and you define a unitary that acts on the fermion annihilation operators in this way, that you take the symmetric combination and define that to be low energy fermion, and take the anti-symmetric combination, define that as high energy. And then once you define it this way, then you can repeat this and define this B fermions in every layer. That you have the B and the A in the next layer makes the B in the next layer. So in the end, you get this new basis B. Say the B in the first layer is just given by this, and the second layer is some different wave function. So in the end, the whole thing is a unitary mapping in a single particle level, which means it's like a Fourier transform, but it's not going to momentum space basis, it's going to some basis called wavelet basis. So for example, what do I mean by creating a fermion here in the bulk? It just means in the boundary or in the original basis, it means you create a fermion with that wave function in that region, plus, minus. So it's all square-shaped waves, and you can check that they are all orthogonal. So you create something there, then it's a square-shaped wave with different size. So this is turns out to be a known basis called Haar wavelet. It's the simplest wavelet basis. It's something that knows something about the spatial locality, but also knows something about energy scale, because you have the wavelets with different size. Okay, so now we are simply just calculating correlation functions in this new basis. And then I will skip this. And then you can check the correlation function in different directions. And let me briefly mention the benchmark case, which is the critical state. So you take m goes to take zero mass, zero temperature. You take zero mass, zero temperature. And then you calculate distance between different points. Then in different directions. So let's first look at this angle direction. And then, of course, you get this log L, you get this log of x minus y distance. And then now you can fit this with the geodesic distance in the hyperbolic space. And it basically looks like that. And so basically, if you only know the power law, then you can only determine R over cosine. But if you also look at the corrections to the long distance behavior, which is log L, then you can actually separately determine R and the cosine in this formula. And then you can also look at the radial direction. So that's a slightly more non-trivial because the these points, as I mentioned earlier, they correspond to electrons with wave packets, with these wavelets around the same position, but they have different sizes. So although the wave functions are orthogonal, they actually naively, they are around the same position, so they can be related by, say, Hopping terms in the Hamiltonian. So why do I have so when you calculate the correlation functions, indeed, you find the locality in that direction. What that means is you calculate this, say, correlation function between this site and this site, and you find that the correlation does decay exponentially with their distance. And this is the key that allows you to think this as an emergent new direction. And what that means is when you have degrees of freedom with very different energy scales, although they overlap in real space, they actually have very little correlation. And that's just because they have so different size that the overlap between them is only an exponentially small part of the bigger one. That's roughly speaking the intuition. So that tells you that the distance does decay exponentially in terms of the ADS distance in both directions. And then we can also talk about imaginary time direction. And then it also agrees with the ADS qualitatively. And what that means physically is that there is this redshift factor. It means not only you can not only talk about the state, but you can talk about time evolution. And the time evolution given by the two-point functions in imaginary time decays slower and slower when you go to the interior because you have these low-energy fermions there. The time evolution is slowed down, and that gives you this redshift factor. So, and then after checking this, the more interesting case is when we go to other states, because basically all these properties of this critical system is sort of almost built in, because I designed the mapping such that I'm doing the right RG for this system. So you have scale invariance, and so scale invariance almost determines all these things. Because this is just a change of basis. So I'm calculating like these imaginary time correlation functions of these B, but the B are linearly related to the boundary fermions. So we know how to calculate boundary fermion imaginary time evolution because we have the Hamiltonian. And so, yeah. So now let's go to other states because where we don't have this nice scaling invariance, this symmetry to build in, then see if the results are reasonable. So the most interesting case is, of course, is black hole. I also checked other cases like massive ground state, but I won't talk about that here. So the black hole case, so the black hole case, let's start from a thermal ensemble, because what I need is correlation function in the new basis. So I can give you a mixed state, which is the thermal ensemble, and calculate correlation function from there in the new basis, and that will give me the new geometry correspond to the finite temperature. So what happened is you calculate the distance in different directions, and let's see why this now this geometry doesn't look like ADS anymore, but it looks like black hole. So the first evidence is from the spatial direction correlation. So if you calculate points between like two points like this and calculate their correlation function, of course we know at finite temperature you get exponential decay rather than power law decay, right? So basically what you get is you get at very short range, because I'm going to consider temperature that's very low, and at short range where the length is much smaller than the temperature, 1 hour temperature, then you still have power law decay, which translates to the log behavior of the distance. And at long distance, you will cross over to exponential decay. But the more important thing is this exponential decay slope is growing exponentially when you go into this direction, which is basically saying physically two neighboring sites when you go to infrared, two neighboring sites are further and further away. In the ground state case, although they are further and further away, there is this scale invariance, so their distance doesn't grow. So what happened in the zero temperature is the distance between two neighboring points in each layer does not grow. So when you look at the circumference, you go around and look at the circumference just decays exponentially because the number of sites decays exponentially. But here is very different because here the distance between two neighboring points grows exponentially, which is this slope. It grows exponentially, and if you measure the circumference, actually it saturates to a finite value rather than zero. So this is saying is that if you, although the geometry looks like a disk, the geometry of the tensor network is still the same as before, looks like a disk. But if you live in that universe, you wouldn't think that as a disk because you walk around the circle and you find that the distance you measured is approaching a constant rather than zero when you're going around the smaller and smaller circle. So that's the meaning that if you use this distance measure I define, then this geometry actually has a hole in the center. So then the reason why I think that as a black hole is by looking at a time direction, because you may have other defects like a wall near the center which blocks you. But that's not what it is, because you look at time direction and you can check the infinite redshift. So when you go to infrared, what happened is there is a region near the center. The center of your network now becomes the stretched horizon region of the black hole. And what happened there is the temperature is much higher than your energy scale of electrons there. So you are basically in a high temperature limit, because the energy scale is going down, temperature is constant. So you have a region here, which is in the high temperature limit, so the correlation function will become almost time independent. And that translates to the fact that this time direction circle shrinks to a point, because you plot this distance as a function of the imaginary time, then you find it's almost not increasing, which means the correlation function is almost not decrease. That's the behavior in the high temperature. It's a imaginary time because, otherwise I don't know how to treat this oscillating.
So what's the right size, kind of like light cone or what's the
meaning? Sorry?
Oh, figures.
This is the distance?
Between three cones, it's kind of light cone.
Oh, these ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just schematically showing. The reason why I want to calculate this time direction distance is I want to compare with black hole. And this light cone picture is that's for real time.
Yeah, that's
and what happens when you rotate to imaginary time is this: is that the time direction becomes a circle, and the circle shrinks to a point at the horizon. And in real time, what happens is you know this light-like, so the time direction becomes light-like at the horizon.
So you mean in your computation, in the end of the day, you can still apply weaker rotation to go back to real time?
No. I'm just drawing this to schematically show the relation to black hole. What I'm actually calculating and compare with is this imaginary time circle.
Do you see this is true for all temperatures compared to the ADS scale? Or?
Actually, there is a transition, which means the temperature should be bigger than 2 by over L. L is the system size.
So you're seeing this hole for large temperatures?
For large temperature, yeah.
Which is backwards.
So no. No.
By the high temperatures, it should be a thermal gas.
No, it's the other way around. It's the high temperature corresponds to black hole, low temperature corresponds to thermal gas. Well, the bigger black holes, the ADS... the
big black holes are low temperature.
No, they are actually, in ADS space, the bigger black hole is high temperature. Robert, am I right?
Yeah.
That's
right.
So it's opposite to the flat space, actually. So this cross, I mean, it's not a Hawking phase transition here, it's a crossover. But the crossover does happen at a temperature that's 2 pi over L, because if the temperature is below that, the system is effectively massive, because there is a finite size gap with 2 pi over L. So, okay, and you can also talk about entropy, because that's another thing that's different from tensor network description of a state, because I have the dynamics in the bulk and can calculate correlation, so of course I can also calculate entropy of each site, and the entropy is basically maximum over each site. So you should think that this stretched horizon region, it contains a lot of sites, but they all squeezed near the black hole boundary. But each of them still carries this entropy. And actually, this entropy, you can understand better if you look at the double system. The entropy is actually the entropy of the entanglement entropy to the thermal bath. So that corresponds to this construction, which means that I can apply the unitaries not only to this thermal ensemble, but to a pure state, which gives me the thermal ensemble. So I can consider the doubled system, where two identical spin chains, and the way you design the state of them so that when you trace over one of them, the other one looks thermal ensemble. So that's the thermal doubled state, what is called a thermal doubled state. In general, you can write the state like this. So it's a one-to-one entanglement between some states in the two systems with that Boltzmann weight. So if you trace over one of them, you get a thermal ensemble. Okay, so now I can apply the same mapping to both sides. And then what do you get? What you get is that you get the geometry, if you only look at a single side of the geometry, which means if you only calculate distance between points like this, then it looks the same as what we just shown for the single-sided case, because you only need to reduce density matrix. But if you look at the distance between points between the two systems, then you can probe this. It's like this two-sided black hole, like the in this work. like the eternal black hole case, where you have two outside regions and you can talk about distance between them. They are not traversable. I mean, it's not a traversable wormhole, but you can talk about spatial distance between them by calculating entanglement between them. And what you see is indeed, when temperature is higher than the energy scale, everything is maximally entangled with the other side. And that's what it means, that there is a wormhole. So the distance between two sides that are right on top of each other exponentially decays to zero. And that gives you, that tells you the fact that the two sides are actually connected near the IR. Okay. So, yeah?
So for the entanglement side, two systems is entangled, we do measurement on one system, we observe the result of the other. How to understand this correspondence on the classical geometry of the wormhole?
Which correspondence?
The entanglement and the wormhole correspondence.
So I think in a classical case, you will also have entanglement between states of the two sides, although they cannot communicate with each other, but there is entanglement between two sides of the wormhole, which is actually what gives you the thermal entropy. Because if you trace over the other side, this side looks like finite temperature. If you look at both sides together, it's a...
Oh, what I mean is that you got the classical geometry of the wormhole.
Uh-huh.
And then how does the information about the classical geometry related with the entanglement of the
quantum system? Well, basically the entanglement entropy is proportional to the throat area of the wormhole. I'm not sure if that's okay. What you mean, but how does that, well, the way it's related is I calculate the distance between the points, and there is a scale where the distance is almost zero, which means there you can think of this infrared states as just EPR pairs, and then you connect them. So the classical geometry stops there, and that's like the throat area, like the black hole horizon area. And that is proportional to the entropy, entanglement entropy between the two systems. Okay, so then we can also consider quench of the black hole, which means you do a time evolution to that thermal double state. And the time evolution, you can do it in two ways, but one of them change the state. You can do it, do a time evolution and then ask how does the geometry change. And this time evolution is defined in a way that it doesn't change the thermal density matrix of each side. So if you calculate physical correlations within each side, it doesn't change at all. But the correlation between two sides changes, because the entanglement got basically scrambled. So at time zero, you have this infrared states forming EPR pairs, and at finite time, they start to get entanglement. Although the entanglement entropy between the two systems is the same, the entanglement is not simply EPR pairs. A spin on the left side, or a fermion on the left side is locally here, is entangled with something that's spreaded on the other side. So if you measure the distance between the two points, they get longer. So this is the picture which says, so I would like to compare this to a particular slice in the bulk geometry. So I think this if I use the same mapping, but change, but do this, apply it to the finite time state, then the geometry looks like this red slice. Means it's exactly the same related by symmetry to the slice on each side, but the distance between the two got increased. And then there is of course, the interesting question, how do I go inside the black hole? So Hartmann and Malasina's paper in 2013, tried to probe the inside by saying like the distance between the two or the entanglement, if you cut the system this way, is related to a minimal surface when you go inside the system. And then we can ask what that corresponds to in terms of tensor networks. So they propose some tensor network like this. They say if you think about this inside slice, it looks more like as time goes on, this throat part grows. So it's like at the beginning, you have EPR pairs between this system and the other system. And when you do time evolution, you can ignore the time evolution of the of all the high energy degrees of freedom. Just look at time evolution of the low energy, and then the time evolution is given by this unitary circuit. It's like a discretized time evolution this way. But I don't think this corresponds to the slice like that, because this throat area cannot shrink. We know when you look at the geometry going into the black hole, the throat should get longer and thinner, right? And when you approach the singularity, the throat gets thinner and thinner. And how can that be possible? If you think that this what happened to the tensor network is there is a unitary evolution between the infrared state of this one and the infrared state of that one, then this will never be possible because the evolution must be unitary. You have to preserve the entanglement entropy between the two sides. So the throat is never shrinking. And for that purpose, to understand the inside of black hole, I would like to propose some different tensor network. And the relation, so this is this problem that the throat never shrinks is related to another problem, which is if you think of this region as unitary circles, then you don't have quantum states living here. In my point of view, I would think that you have some quantum states living in this region, which is like what I calculated. But in this region, if you put a unitary evolution there, there is no quantum states. It's a finite temperature for each side, which means if you trace over the other system, it's a finite temperature.
Yeah, the whole system is still
the whole system is a pure space. Yes. So that's related to the. Is it? Yeah. Okay. So that's related to the observation that if you want to have something describing quantum states falling in black hole, then this state must depend on both systems. There is this state, the difference between inside and outside of the horizon is inside the horizon, the state depends on both sides. So say an operator here will know about operators in both systems, but an operator outside the horizon will only depend on one of the two sides. So I think that's related to the fact that the throat shrinks. So when you have quantum states inside the system, it's like you are introducing some new unitary mapping which couples the two systems. So then the entanglement between the two systems can be changed in the new basis. So, okay.
You assume it's Minkowski metric or you still use it
Euclidean? Actually, this picture is Minkowski. So it's like, now I really have real-time evolution, but I don't talk about distance between different time. I don't know how to define that. So I talk about spatial geometry in the real-time evolution. Yes. So now to modify this and also to apply this approach to a more general states, I would like to propose is a general way to define the tensor network, because for that particular state, we basically use physical intuition to define this unitary that separates high energy and low energy states. So more generally, how do we define these unitaries? And to do that, I would like to first, as I mentioned earlier, I would like to first modify the tensor network to allow these disentanglers. So previously, I have this only the coarse graining step, like two sides coarse grain to one side and the high energy degree of freedom. And as I mentioned, that's okay. That's okay here because I have entanglement between these sides. But in general, I should also allow these disentanglers, because basically, so if you allow them, what happens is you can make these sides even shorter range entangled. You can make them even less entangled, and the geometry is sort of more classical, which means the box states will look more massive. That's basically what happens. And so it's like there is a trade between the entanglement you put in the tensor network itself and the entanglement of the remaining box states. And then I can even add more layers of tensor disentanglers. Okay, so now the question is, what is the criteria to define these disentanglers? So I would like to propose a entanglement of criteria. In the MIRA, usually it was energy criteria which was applied. But I would like to propose entanglement criteria because that's the purpose of our mapping, right? They want to make the box states short range entangled. So the entanglement criteria is like this. Like I apply these unitaries on the two sides, and let me assume translation symmetry. So there is a unitary apply on the same unitary apply on side 3, 4. And then I want to define a principle that I want to vary the unitary and minimize the entropy of these two output sides. Why do I want to do that? Because next step, I may take these two sides to one side, And if these two sites has a small entropy, then this output, this red dot can have a small entropy. And if the red dot has a small entropy, then the correlation between the two points cannot be too big. The mutual information is bounded by the entropy. So it's a way to try to make the box states closer to a Dirac product state. So if this is in the extreme case, if you really get this state to be pure, then that's saying, I find a mirror that's the exact representation of the state. Usually that's not possible, and you still have a finite entropy here, but I have tried to minimize it. That's basically what this is doing. And then now when we go to the black hole case, we need another twist, which means this is related to our purpose of going into the black hole. Means we should allow unitary transformations that couple the two systems. So I define two kinds of disentanglers. One is this represented by each slice, which is like the one in the previous picture, like this one, which applies to each slice and try to get these red dots to be minimal entropy. And then the other layer is you can introduce in between, which is unitary mapping applied between the two systems. And I use the same criteria that when you apply the unitary mapping between the two systems, you also minimize the two site entropy between the two neighboring sites. And then, so what is this doing is it's trying to see what is the best way to find the states that are short range entangled. And say if you have this black hole, if you have this thermal double state, and then you evolve it to some scale where this temperature is already much higher than the energy scale here, then basically all these sites become EPR pairs. And then this unitary will know that. It will say, now if I do this vertical unitary between the two, I can map it to Dirac product state, and then you're done. Then all the entanglement is captured by the tensor network, and you don't need to do further mapping. So basically this disentangler is doing that. I don't determine by hand when I apply this. I basically apply one layer of this, one layer of that, starting from the beginning. And this unitary actually will know that if you are here, like you have these high energy degrees of freedoms, which are almost not entangled with each other, then this vertical unitary does not do much. So it will almost don't do anything. But when you come to the scale comparable to temperature, then the unitary, the vertical unitary will start to work. And when you do the time evolution, this will change because the entanglement is more than local in space. So you find the unitary here will start to work later. So basically that's what happened, that the throat is getting longer, you have to do more layers of unitaries before you can disentangle the whole system. So now we apply it to this black hole case. And now because we have allowed this unitary that couple the two sides, our box states will generically depend on two sides of the system. And you'll find that when you are near the ultraviolet, it almost doesn't depend on the other side. So it's like outside the black hole, and then it goes inside the black hole. So say this is one quantity that's very important to check. So after every step of the mapping, one horizontal, one vertical disentanglers, I will calculate this quantity, which is the entropy of each site. This is the low energy site. The entropy of each low energy site, each site means including both systems. The entropy of each site, and you sum over them and subtract the total entropy of all the sites together. So it's like a mutual information, but it's multipartite mutual information. I don't know if there's a name for this. But basically, it's like you sum over the entropy of each of them, subtract the total entropy. And if this is zero, that means there is no entanglement at all between any two sites. And that means that each site is like an EPR pair between the two. Or it may not be the maximal entangled EPR pair, but some local entanglement between the two. And there is no entanglement at all between the different sites. If you reach that point, you don't need to do further unitaries. So that's where the blue region is. So at time zero, where you reach this direct product of EPR pairs is basically the scale set by temperature. So this is the fourth layer. The temperature is 2^4, and 2^-4. And then as time goes on, this goes up, which means which means if you come here, it's still not EPR pairs because the quench time evolution makes every electron here entangle with something that local in the other side. So you get something that you need further disentangling before you reach a point where it's just simple EPR pairs. And this is, I think this is telling you the growth of that throat. And then you can also calculate distance between two sides and basically to verify that indeed the two sides are still connected. So basically the two systems should be connected around this scale where you have this EPR pairs. And then what you have seen is the distance between the two systems. The distance, say the red one is the early one. The distance between two systems will go down. And if you keep running, this going up again is because I'm not stopping the circuit. I'm running the algorithm until the end. So if you already have these EPR pairs, but you don't stop, then it can just, you can keep going and it can go up because things are disentangled, so their distance goes up. But what is physically meaningful is only until the dip. So it's saying that the distance between the two points goes down until it becomes EPR pairs, and then you can think the two systems that's connected there. And you can measure the throat area, and the area goes down, not surprisingly, just because it's going deeper into the tensor network. But it's not smooth. So as you see here, the curves do not look smooth compared to what I did before. It looks like the quality of the data is going down. And that's because now what I'm doing is at every time I take this quench, this time evolved state, and then I run this optimization criteria to find a unitary circuit, right? So you are finding a set of unitaries for each given time. And the problem is these unitaries, the unitaries are determined by this minimal entropy criteria, and it's not a continuous function of the state. Because there are different choices, one is slightly better than the other, and as time goes on, suddenly this one is slightly worse than the other. So this is really a problem of optimizing the tensor network, which I think always exists for the discrete systems. Because the tensor network, well, as long as you require your tensor to be optimizing some criteria, it generally always occurs that it's not a continuous function of your state. So I think it describes the qualitative behavior as well, but if I want to talk about, say, time evolution, correlation function between different time, then this artifact comes in that the unitaries are not so smooth. Maybe it's better to define some other criteria, but you have to define a criteria which doesn't minimize anything.
You mean like at time 7, along this 7 years jump, because this...
Where? This one?
Yeah, the tail is...
Oh, that one. Oh, no, that jump is actually physical. That's because the... I'm plotting it in a log scale. If you plot in linear scale, this going down and this go up is symmetric. So what happened is the free fermion system, this when you do time evolution, the entanglement got scrambled. So the throat gets longer, but afterwards it will come back. There's an oscillation in time, which is half the system size. Because basically what happened is you create some entanglement locally and they propagate and they meet on the other half of in the other side of the system. And that should be something special for the free theory. But that also is a problem that says I cannot really study any long time behavior in a time much longer than system size, where I'm supposed to get all these complexity growth of black hole throats. The throat will keep growing in the classical geometry. It will keep growing exponentially. Growing linearly in time until the time is exponentially long in system size. But that doesn't appear in the free system. So I'm running over time, so I will skip this part, which is saying I apply this to a topological state, and then I apply to the topological state with the edge state and trying to relate that to a black hole that can evaporate. And then in summary, basically, this is an approach which I wouldn't say it's an explanation of the known holographies in the more standard approach, but it's another holographic duality in a simpler system, which explicitly relates quantum states to some geometry. And you can see that properties like having black holes are probably more generic than these particular deals of semi-classical gravity is probably even exist in these systems that are far from semi-classical. And it gives a new approach to do basically generalized RG. And of course, there is a lot of open questions, like how do I describe a single-sided black hole to understand better the information paradox? That's one of the next steps. That's after we describe this mapping that goes inside the black hole for a two-sided black hole, then we want to understand the single side. Okay, thank you.
Let's thank Sean and Nick.
Thank you.